First up, it's Ruse Number 1, The Case of the Degenerating Detective. Contributing writer Tommy Wallach brings us the story of the laziest, but also maybe the best, private investigator in all of Seattle.
First of all, this is a detective story. And at the heart of every good detective story, there's a mystery. In this case, it's not about cheating husbands or graphic violence or possible CIA involvement, though all of those things come into play. The real mystery is about the detective, and it goes something like this. How does a private investigator who has no work ethic, who is missing a leg, and who is legally blind manage to make a living? I call it the case of the degenerating detective. I first met Patty Calabresi when I was 18. My mom had interned with him during a brief post-retirement flirtation with detective work, inspired by her attempts to locate an old French boyfriend of hers, Patrick Chapuis. To find him again after 30 years, she'd had to hire detectives in 3 countries. It took months, but she enjoyed the process so much she decided to pursue it as a second-string career. For a brief period of time, she was both an airline pilot and a private detective. After a few cases, however, she decided the work wasn't for her, which is how it felt to me. My family seems to have a genetic predisposition for mysteries. While I didn't meet my father until I was 12, when I did, I discovered that he was, among other things, a professional magician. My mother raised me on the Hardy Boys, the Boxcar Children, and my personal favorite, Murder, She Wrote, the TV show starring Angela Lansbury as novelist/detective Jessica Fletcher. So when my mom suggested I help Patty out for the summer, it sounded like a dream job. I'd be just like Jessica Fletcher, only without the old person smell. I first met Patty at his office, an old-fashioned storefront in Seattle's Pioneer Square, distinguished by a huge neon eye affixed to the brickwork outside. When I came in, he was sitting at a large mahogany desk, chomping on a cigar. At least 60 years old, he reminded me of J. Jonah Jameson, the brash, blunt, quaintly chauvinistic newspaper editor from Spider-Man. Within 20 minutes of our meeting, he'd enlisted me to join him on my first case, though not before giving his opinion on my style of dress and general appearance. Some crack detective work revealed I needed nicer shoes and should try to eat more. The case was what passes for bread and butter in the private detective business. In 2 weeks' time, we would travel to the inn at Point Pleasant, a hotel about 4 hours away on the Olympic Peninsula. We'd been asked to attend a corporate event at the behest of a board member's wife, who believed her husband was still cheating on her with one of his co-workers. He'd been caught once before, but claimed the affair was over. We were supposed to find out if that were true. The next couple weeks I spent answering phones and speaking with walk-ins at the office taught me that the only thing on most of our clients' minds was whom their loved ones were sleeping with. I started to think that Jessica Fletcher was pretty damn lucky to have stumbled upon all those grisly homicides. Say what you will about murder, at least it's a bold gesture. In his defense, Patty had never planned to get into the PI business. In fact, he had what might be the most bizarre history of any private detective in the country. As a child in Buffalo, New York, Pasquale Calabrese, nicknamed Patty, was raised in the world of organized crime. The infamous Buffalo crime family, run by the Magadino clan, was a branch of the mafia that could trace its lineage back to the inception of La Cosa Nostra in the U.S. during the first few decades of the 20th century. So powerful that it was often referred to simply as the arm, the Magadino family had Patty made by the time he was 25 years old. Unfortunately, he interpreted that to mean he'd become invincible overnight. The account of his attempted holdup of the treasurer's office at Buffalo City Hall paints him less like a cunning mafioso enacting a well-conceived heist than a two-bit thug desperate for spending money. The stunt landed him 5 years in prison and a large black mark in the mob's books. Figuring he should reap what he'd sown, the Magadinos refused to support Patty's family after his conviction. To their surprise, instead of taking this insult like a good underling, he turned state's evidence, becoming the first person ever to enter WITSEC, or what is more commonly known as the Witness Protection Program. From there, the story only gets stranger. When Patty was relocated by the government, he brought along his new wife, Rochelle, who had 3 children from a previous marriage. These children, who typically divided their time between Rochelle and her husband, were entered into WITSEC. Their names were changed and the records of their relocation sealed. Their father woke up one day to discover he no longer had children. His search for them, which lasted a number of years, was recounted in a book called Hide in Plain Sight, which which was eventually turned into a film, directed by and starring James Caan. Danny Aiello's in it too, of course, because it's about the mob. Soon after their relocation, Patty divorced Rochelle and began doing undercover work for the police to pay the bills. He shed his false name, as the Buffalo crime family had disintegrated not long after he testified against them, and opened his own detective agency, Intertel. Though he did a lot of legitimate work with the police, it was the divorce jobs that paid the bills. Before long, the majority of his clients were jilted wives and cuckolded husbands. Two other things I think I should mention. First, Patty was severely diabetic. His diabetes was the stuff of nightmares. One of his favorite stories to tell was about how he'd lost his left leg. "I was walking around the pool at this hotel in Miami," he'd explain in a voice husky with braggadocio, "and I went to the lobby to grab an extra towel. Concierge says, 'Sir, your foot's bleeding.' I looked down and the thing's practically melted off." Because of the lack of sensation that is one of the symptoms of late-stage diabetes, Patty hadn't felt his foot burning on the cement around the pool. By the time he'd arrived at the hospital, the infection had spread too far. Along with his leg, the diabetes had also claimed Patty's vision. In spite of this, he still occasionally drove from work to home, a stunt he pulled off through a combination of memorization, squinting hard enough to make out the lane dividers, and being chummy with the entire Seattle police force. Obviously, on the way up to the inn at Point Pleasant, I drove. By the time we checked into the hotel, the opening mixer was already underway. I posed as Patty's son, getting a bead on our man, the possibly reformed husband, while my so-called father flirted loudly with the spiky-haired bartender, asking a few relevant questions, but mostly just screwing around. It was my job to ID the guy, because Patty was unable to make out faces reliably. I finally located him, standing in the corner with a group of men. They were yucking it up as if congregated around an imaginary water cooler. The woman with whom he'd previously been involved entered a few minutes later, but she and her one-time lover never so much as shared a glance. I snapped pictures of them while pretending to photograph the lake outside. After about 20 minutes of this, Patty was ready to call it a night. "Put the camera away," he said. "Nothing's going on here." "You're right," I answered. "They wouldn't do anything out in the open." "That's not what I mean," Patty clarified. "There's nothing going on here. It's done. They're done." By Patty's reckoning, we'd discharged our duty. The job was over. When I said that we ought to watch the couple's rooms tonight to see if they sneaked out, Patty waved me away. "We can't work 24 hours a day," he said. Of course, I'd already seen the envelope full of $100 bills, our client's upfront payment for a solid weekend of surveillance. It was at that moment that I realized I was working for a fraud. The PIs are supposed to be symbols of take-no-prisoners truth-seeking. Where was the dedication? Where was the stakeout? What would Jessica Fletcher think? That night, I slipped out of my cot at the foot of Patty's bed. I knew what floor our client's husband was on, but not his supposed paramour. For more than 2 hours, I prowled up and down the stairs and hallways, ready at any moment to put on the appearance of a wayward, possibly deranged guest. Once, I heard the sound of a door cracking open behind me, which shut again as soon as I turned around. What Patty had said ended up being true. The only way to really know what someone's doing is to watch them all the time, and nobody can do that. "I want to know what asshole my ex-wife is dating," another client told me over the phone. It was the first case Patty let me take on alone. I was supposed to follow the ex-wife around and keep track of where she went. If I were lucky, I'd happen upon the asshole. She always left her house around 7:30 in the morning, and I felt about as subtle as a police car with its siren blaring as I pulled out and followed her to the freeway. She drove a slick new Mercedes, and I was driving a 1984 Volvo station wagon, a car that actually groaned when called upon to climb any grade steeper than a wheelchair ramp. I managed to keep her in sight all week, but she never met up with anyone, and our client decided to pull the plug. For all I know, his ex was dating Brad Pitt, or no one at all. But what was weird is that I really didn't care. Imagine watching an episode of Scooby-Doo all the way up to the point where the crew is about to pull off the mask of the terrifying monster and just turning off the television. That was the kind of person I'd become. 2 months, and only a few cases as a private eye, and I was already sick to death of mysteries. It was late August when Patty and I went out on our last case together. A woman had called the office claiming that her apartment was bugged. The Patriot Act had recently been passed into law, so I figured anything was possible. Her directions led us to a project tenement downtown. There were holes in the walls and graffiti everywhere. Certain apartments within the building were condemned, cordoned off from the hallways with a few strands of yellow caution tape. Our client, who looked 25 from a few angles and 45 from all the rest, had the taut, ravaged skin and patchy hair of someone suffering from severe malnutrition. Some part of her body was always moving, and she spoke with the frantic gravity of a meth addict or auctioneer. "I'm so f***ing glad to see you guys," she said. "There are voices coming out of my oven." She pointed towards the vent above her range. Patty listened closely, then gestured for me to hand him the metal briefcase I was carrying. Inside was a very professional-looking bug-sniffing device. The woman was clearly impressed. "Show me where you think the microphones are," Patty said. The bug sniffer made a humming, fluttering noise, kind of like when a bee gets really close to your ear. When Patty pointed it towards the electrical outlets, the frequency leapt a couple of octaves. I kept one eye on the woman, who I feared might try to kill us for drug money, or because she wanted Jodie Foster to notice her. Patty asked me to unscrew the outlet cover. The plaster disintegrated as I removed the sockets, and after exploratory surgery inside the wall turned up nothing irregular, our client was left with a gaping hole in her wall. I wanted Patty to tell this woman that she was crazy, and to seek help, so we could leave. Instead, he continued scanning the room. It soon became obvious, to me at least, that the bug sniffer was nothing but a glorified metal detector. It registered when pointed at the television, the VCR, the free weights in the corner, even some of the studs in the walls. "What do you think?" our client asked, wringing her hands. Patty considered for a moment. "I think you might have something." "What?" I couldn't help but say. "That thing went off wherever you pointed it." "Sure," Patty answered, "but there were some reactions in the wall. I want to check out more." I couldn't understand what was happening. Patty had been on this job for years now. He was no Jessica Fletcher, but he was no idiot either. This woman was so obviously a nut job, she was practically a cliché. I stood there, speechless, as our client's anxiety suddenly gave way to friendliness, even what might have passed at an NA meeting for composure. She started telling Patty about her father. Apparently, he'd worked in Nicaragua during the Iran-Contra scandal, which was why she believed the CIA had bugged her apartment. After 20 minutes of chatting, he brought the conversation back around to the job. "Maybe I could come by again later in the week with some other equipment. We could grab a bite to eat afterwards." "That'd be nice," the woman said. "Of course," Patty hastened to add, "I'll still have to charge my usual rate." So that was the plan. All the talk about her father, the seeming sympathy about the voices, it was just a cover. Patty was exploiting her paranoia to get more business. The woman paid up an amount of money that had to be a significant percentage of her savings, and for the first time since I'd started working as a detective, I was angry. Patty had made me complicit in his deception. I was on the brink of walking out, of leaving him there to find his own way home. Just this once, he'd be the one left in the dark, instead of his clients. And at that moment, as I was about to strand a nearly blind old man in a bad neighborhood, the woman took Patty's hand in hers. She leaned forward so he could put his arms around her. "Thank you," she said. Out in the hall, Patty tried to explain what had happened. "Sometimes," he said, "you just have to tell people what they want to hear." I hadn't known about Patty's history with the mafia while I was working for him. In fact, I didn't learn about it until earlier this year, when I went on the radio to speak about the summer I'd spent as a private eye. During that same conversation, I learned that Patty had died of a heart attack a few years before, in 2005. It's awkward to learn about someone's death on the air. A response was expected, of regret or grief or even ambivalence. But I didn't know what to say. After everything that had happened, how did I feel about Patty? Hide in Plain Sight, the book based on Patty's life, or the lives of the people he affected, at any rate, doesn't paint a pretty picture of the man. He doesn't come across with the pathos of a Tony Soprano or the moral anxiety of a Michael Corleone. Instead, we find just another petty criminal, possibly abusive towards his family, who manages to pull off two separate robberies. The literal one that he only escaped by betraying his mafia family, and the figurative one involving his wife's children. But the Patty I knew, a 60-year-old man flirting with 20-year-old bartenders and pridefully recounting all the criminals he'd helped to catch during his time with the police, didn't resemble the character in the film at all. I couldn't help but remember how he'd treated that woman in the tenement, the gentle way he'd allowed her to maintain her illusions. And what about that first client, who feared her husband was still sleeping with another woman? Did Patty do the same thing for her? After all, she'd already caught her husband cheating once, and she'd managed to forgive him for that. Maybe Patty figured it was better to allay her fears, even if they were warranted. Maybe that was just his style, his P.I.M.O. Every day he had to balance truth and deception, maintaining his client's hopes in the face of despair and disappointment. It was a job that even a half-blind, half-ambulatory ex-mafioso slacker could do, but not because it was easy, just because he had what it took. To be honest, I still haven't decided whether or not Patty was a good man, but I'm convinced now that he was a good detective. "I'm very sorry to hear he's gone," was what I said to my interviewer, just a few moments after she informed me that Patty had passed away. While my summer as a detective taught me nothing, if not that the business of a private eye can be squalid and corrupt, it also showed me that there's a fine line between deceit and grace. It was sad to think that Patty would no longer be there in his office, promising to solve people's mysteries, but really doing more to solve their problems. And sure, maybe I'm romanticizing. Maybe Patty really was just lazy, or indifferent, or dishonest. But I choose to think that he was better than that. Obituarists enjoyed mentioning the fact that Patty had always bragged he would die of natural causes, and not from a bullet in the back. Far be it from me to take a shot now.
Tommy Wallach is a graduate student in the communication department at Stanford. He can also be found on YouTube.
I got a gift from the bartender. The drink I bought for you marked return to sender. I may be drunk, I may be sober.